Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guest is Mark Maselli. Mark is the CEO and founder of Community Health Center, Inc., which is the largest federally qualified health center organization in Connecticut and a thought leader in primary care delivery across the country. Welcome, Mark, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much, David. I look to get warmed by your virtual hearth.
Excellent. So you have a long and storied career with the Community Health Center in Connecticut, starting in the good old days as a long-haired do-gooder looking to build a free clinic in the community, modeled on other such things around the country. And this has just taken root and grown tremendously over the years. And I'm wondering if you could give us a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of the history and how we get to today.
Well, that's great. And I'm happy to give you an outline of where we've been. And, you know, it was back in the early 70s when we were trying to figure out how to manage the care of people who were coming to us, because we had been at that point running a crisis intervention center. Young people, probably not different than today, were experiencing sort of homelessness. They were experimenting with drugs. And, you know, one of the things we realized very early on was that no one had access to primary care, and that everyone was using emergency rooms for their primary care. So we started off a free clinic. I had some friends who were running the Haight-Ashbury Free Clinic in San Francisco, and they were in the midst of starting a national movement called the National Free Clinic Council. And so we got ourselves a second floor walk-up, a small cold flat, if you will. You really could have been in San Francisco, because there was tie-dye on the wall, beaded curtains separating the doors, and that slight hint of incense, and it really was incense. And we were able to take a kitchen, had some friends at Wesleyan University who helped convert that kitchen into a dental operatory, got some dentists to volunteer locally, and we started off. And I think the good news for us is that we had no money. So we really had to figure out how this ran. We didn't have an entitlement. Nobody said, by the way, here's a grant to get going. We started off because there were Wesleyan students and Middletown activists who were really concerned about access to healthcare. And so, you know, we got underway. We were real proud of ourselves. We'd accomplished so much. And, you know, maybe 4 or 5 months down the road, we get a knock on the door, and I opened it, and it was somebody from the state health department and said, "Kid, do you have a license for this?" And I sort of shrugged and said, "Do you need a license?" So lesson learned, very naive to understand that the healthcare establishment would have been up in arms. Local doctors wrote and said, how is it possible that a non-doctor is running one of these? And, you know, we filled out the forms, we met all the standards. And as the state walked down the hallways, they measured the width of the hallways and said, "You know something, kid? They're 1 inch too narrow." And of course, we couldn't cut the building in half. They gave us a cease and desist order. So lesson learned very early is to understand all the regulations. You know, we picked ourselves up. People who come to any one of our 200 locations in Connecticut today might say, "Why do you have such wide hallways?" We picked ourselves up, and it was really important lesson, I think, in any organizing that you're going to do, is that you really have to persevere. And you also have to have some competency in the area that you're excited about organizing. Since then, and I mentioned that we started off, David, with dental. It really shaped who we were, because soon after adding dental, we added medical and behavioral health. So back in the 70s, we had an integrated primary care operation. And it really wasn't long after that that we got calls from communities around the state who said, "You know, you got this dental. We're senior citizens 20 miles down the road. Medicare doesn't cover dentistry. Will you come down here?" And people liked this model of a fully integrated team-based model. We didn't call it back then. We just said, "This is what we do. We provide medical, dental, and behavioral health services." We grew really in those partnerships. But along the way, we sort of asked ourselves, you know, if you're going to be engaged in primary care, you have an obligation to improve it. And we set out to really think through what that meant. And we formed the Weizmann Institute. And the Weizmann Institute, dedicated after one of our founding board members, really focused in on how do you improve the care that you're delivering through implementation and research science. So we developed this arm of the health center. So we really now have three pillars: excellence in the provision of primary care, all of those primary care services we provide to our 150,000 patients. We have a research arm that's really focusing on improving care. And then we formed a training program to train the next generation of health professionals. So we run the first nurse practitioner residency program in America, founded by Dr. Margaret Flinner, who co-pilots the health center with me maybe 15 plus years ago. That model is now used all over the country. We also formed the National Institute for Medical Assistant Advancement. We're training medical assistants in our Colorado office, but we're training them around the country. And we're doing Project Echoes. Our good friend, Dr. Sanjeev Arora, out of New Mexico, developed a great model, which we use in educating primary care providers in lots of areas around chronic and complex diseases. So that really takes us from those early days of sort of the free clinic movement to a much more sophisticated organization that not only is based in Connecticut with offices through our Weizmann Institute, both in Colorado and in California. And we're engaged in lots of activity around healthcare, healthcare reform, healthcare policy. we're really trying to establish a new model of how what are called community health centers and federally qualified health centers should have as a design model as they think about the growth of the community effort.
And the multi-site model and the size and the geographic dispersion of your model is unique in my experience of dealing with community health centers. And I'm just curious how that came to be rather than developing a network of like-minded health centers. How did you come to instead develop this single entity?
Sure. I guess it gets back to having no money and not being a federal grantee or recipient for the first 20 years of our operation. So we really, again, as I said, had to figure it out on our own, and people came, and we didn't have a mother, may I, which had us really grow throughout the state. As we became funded by the Bureau of Primary Health Care, they have a different set of rules, but I think they are more aligned with us now than they were back then. You know, there's a role for the university system like ours, which is a statewide, and there's a role for community colleges, which are health centers that might be focused in a smaller geographic area. They're a hand-in-glove relationship. I'd say there's a group that we associate ourselves with called Best Practices. There are about 17 of us from Hawaii to East Boston who are probably larger size health centers, maybe a little more sophisticated, all doing the same work. I don't want to differentiate us from the smaller health center that's serving a smaller community, but we've sized up according to needs and responses, and we don't go into communities just to plant a flag. We go in because there's an ask, a partnership, and an opportunity to make a difference.
Right. And the way you're describing it, it sounds like it's really an integrated model of care. So a single front door, someone comes in with a complaint or an issue in one sort of specialty, can end up seeing somebody else down the hall or at another location as well?
Yeah, fully integrated pods. Pods are really, probably for the last 15 years, we've redesigned everything we do. So there's usually a pod of 8 to 10 seats, two primary care providers, two MAs, one nurse, a psychiatrist or a psychologist, a dietitian, maybe a resident or two. That team has a whole hallway, if you will, that they manage their patients at, and they work as a fully interdisciplinary. The whole notion that you'd go to a section of the building and for behavioral health is really sort of antiquated in our mind. You're out in the waiting room and really nobody knows why you're there. You could be seeing the podiatrist, the chiropractor, the physician, the nurse practitioner, the psychiatrist, whomever. And that's team-based. In addition to that, I would say as much as we're a healthcare company, we're an IT company. We're fairly sophisticated. Not only do you check in on kiosk at every one of our locations to check yourself in, if you need to talk to somebody, you can, but it facilitates, and I talked a little bit about the geography, right, that pod, but it's really, David, the choreography. And that requires a sophisticated IT system. So I'm in as a physician in an exam room and I do the depression screen, realize this person, in addition to why they're here for a medical reason, really has a need to talk to a behavioralist. And I can link immediately and have somebody come in at the end of the visit, introduce my colleague, if it's a behavioralist or the like, and do that warm handoff. And we do lots of that because you want to see the person. What we've realized is that if I send you to the specialist or to the other colleague in dental or medical, and I just do it by referral, 80% of the time you won't show up. But actually, if somebody comes in and says hello and introduces themselves, maybe we'll break into a full visit if there's time and space there. 80% of the time, they will come back for that referral. So, you know, we've looked at all of this through the Weizmann Institute. We've done sort of our randomized clinical trials and lots of things. But one of the things that we realized along the way is access to specialty care is a very difficult issue for us. And we formed a group called Confer Med. It's one of our affiliates in all nonprofits. And we do specialty referrals, but we did a randomized clinical trial in cardiology back a decade ago, where we half of the clinicians sent them off to the regular cardiologist and the other half sent them off to a virtual specialist. And what we found was fascinating. 60% of the time, the cardiologist that went in the cloud came back and said, this can be managed locally. Let me give you advice. If I saw this person, you know, I would send them back because you could manage it. But 40% of the time they said, this is perfect, but before you send them, don't send them without these diagnostic tests. Because people were going long taxi rides if you were on Medicaid to a specialist because the local specialist didn't take care of you, or you couldn't, their insurance wouldn't allow for it. And this had an enormous impact on the really important element of care delivery when there's a complicated issue that needs somebody's advice. It helped our providers become more knowledgeable because the specialists were consulting back to them. You know, it was like the old hospital curbside conversation that you would have, but no longer anyone rounds. So this has turned out to be an important program. We care for about 1,300,000 lives across the country through e-consults, all in safety net provider settings. But we also do it in our own setting. Our providers access the same specialty thing. So you've got this choreography that happens either on the warm handoff or in the virtual handoff.
I love the image of choreography, and we'll come back to that in just a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guest today is Mark Maselli, CEO of Community Health Center in Connecticut. Mark, we're talking about virtual care and the choreography involved in getting the right sort of service to the right patient at the right time. And we're talking in the age of COVID-19. And I know that many healthcare providers have had to transition quickly to telemedicine. It sounds like you have a leg up, so to speak, having worked in this for a bit already. And many folks have been completely unfamiliar with telemedicine until the age of the coronavirus. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing more broadly in telemedicine at this time.
Yeah, that's great. A great question and such an important, I would say if there's any silver lining in a very, very dark cloud, it's been the rapid adoption of telehealth. I think it's been something that people have wanted to see. There have been enormous regulatory barriers across the country and in each state to really slow its growth. I think we can all go back and sort of give another round of applause maybe 10 years ago or 12 years ago to the smartphone. That really started to lay the groundwork because you need an infrastructure. But the smartphone adoption really changed the trajectory of what would come. We didn't know all of it back then, but we're starting to see it. We had, as I said, on our e-consults and other things had been really tinkering, even though there were no, there wasn't any reimbursement, tinkering with telehealth for a while, and probably set up a group last year to start really looking at it in detail fortuitously. And so when March came around, mid-March, where the virus hit this part of the country in Connecticut, we lost in probably 5 days 60% of our patients and dropping. We were able to stand up in relatively short order. So by the end of the month, we were back at the same levels we were at the beginning of the month. And I will say that's remarkable because we also lost all of our dental visits because the American Dental Association said outside of emergencies, no dental visits. So we had a fairly robust dental program. And the regulatory relief, I think, is an important. CMS and the local Medicaid agencies in various states have said, look, at we're going to allow both phone and video to happen. And so we've stood up both. Obviously, it's easy to stand up the phone side, but we were a Zoom shop long before this. We use Zoom every day of the week for 5-8 years or whatever. So this was very comfortable to our staff who were familiar with it. But it's incredible. The patient embrace of this is so good. And then we have a company in Florida that does our surveys of patients every week. And the results have been just astronomical. I mean, people love it. And we started to ask, what did this save in time? And obviously, they're all at home, so they're somewhat captive. But, you know, we're hearing from, you know, an hour to 3 hours, right, of time. So patients understand this. And we just need to make sure as we get into the post-COVID environment that we don't lose some of this regulatory relief.
It sounds like a heavy lift in terms of federal and state licensing and certification requirements and certainly payment relief that's been offered during the emergency. But this is certainly a consistent theme that so many providers across many ranges of healthcare are using telemedicine. I think it will be hard to go back.
I hope so. I worry a little bit that some of these reliefs in states have been done by executive order. We really need them. We need the legislators back in and codifying these changes. And I think strategically, people around the country, obviously, we're going to work through this real crisis in front of us, but I think we have to be thinking, how do we make sure that we don't lose the advantages we've been given? I also say, you know, on the issue that, I mean, the notion that you're trained at Harvard and you're in Maine and you've got your medical degree there and you can't practice in Connecticut, now that's been waived. But the guilds that sort of exist are really just prevent access to people, and hopefully that's another barrier where we've realized you're a doc somewhere as long as you're credentialed. I mean, you have to do certain things, but the hurdles that have been put in a way for people just make this system inefficient. So again, hopefully things that we will come out on the other side without.
Ryan, you've talked a little bit about digital tools beyond telehealth, but I'd like to explore that a little further. Could you tell us a little bit more about the digital tools that you're using, maybe beyond an electronic health record, and how those facilitate the care that you're able to provide?
Well, a lot of people have home monitoring devices, right? And so, you know, I think we're giving out more and more home monitoring devices for people. So they can check their sugar level or check their blood pressure or lots of other instrumentation that's there. And, you know, that's part of it. I think, though, early on, we'll see the linking up of these locally to what we're doing through our patient portal. But obviously patients at portal, everybody has a portal who comes to the health center and they can access that. We can download information, but we want to be able to upload that. I think also we'll see a little more sophistication happening on Zoom, at least, and other platforms that are HIPAA compliant. I should note that we are, these platforms for us are HIPAA compliant, though the feds have allowed some non-HIPAA compliant platforms for right now. So, you know, we're using this. We're also using our Project Echo video case-based learning. So we're, I think we're using as many tools as we can. And probably once we establish the base being 10 times the size that it was before, we'll see a lot of folks that are adopting this. I think one thing is making sure patients are in control of their data. There are a lot of people who are working at this. I know the ONC has put forward some stuff. Our good friends are Todd Park and Anish Chopra, and Farzad Mustashari, all sort of, you know, liberating data, very excited about patient control of information. We're looking for that to happen so that, you know, this the one thing we lack now is that there's no way for a patient to trust us with their data because they don't have that function on their phone. I think we're going to see that happening, David, down the road very soon. I think people are ready for it. And I think this will be a hand-in-glove relationship with what we have.
Right. I mean, it seems inevitable, right? The train is moving down the track, so to speak, and there's certainly a need for greater integration of all these data streams. And you mentioned patient portals, and we often talk about the problem of portalitis or too many portals or poorly designed portals, and we need to move past that. And certainly some of the folks you mentioned have been working on that For quite a while and trying to move this forward.
And you're really right about poorly designed portals. I mean, God, as the kids say, gag me with a chainsaw. Really, they're so bad. I mean, they're, you know, it's got to be Facebook-like. You know, it's got to have, or Instagram or however you want, whatever your favorite is, but it's got to be something that, you know, people want to share information and that's their right to do it. But we've got to figure out ways to make it more engaging. It's just so boring. I think that's part of this challenge in terms of the development of how to get over some of the just hurdles that I understand on the healthcare side, but that's not how the rest of the world works.
Right. So it sounds like you've taken some steps down that path already. Is there anything specific that you haven't already mentioned that you'd want to say?
In the background, you know, we have a large business intelligence team. I think part of the modern day healthcare organization, it really requires you to, in a sophisticated way, mine your data, because there's just a lot happening with patients that get missed. And we have to have more sophisticated tools that are really focused in on trying to improve patient outcomes. I think that's the biggest challenge. We can see lots of patients. We do 700,000 or 800,000 visits a year, but, you know, it's about, are we improving outcomes? And I think that's the biggest challenge in healthcare now. And you can't improve outcomes unless you can understand the population in front of you and look at their health conditions.
Right. Well, that's a tremendous challenge. So, Mark, to wrap things up, I want to ask you, if you were to wake up tomorrow and find yourself 5 years in the future, what is one thing in healthcare today that you would hope or expect to find has changed drastically?
I would hope that we would see the type of embrace of the consumer-based model in healthcare. And what we would lose is the medical domination of the industry without any regard to the needs of consumers. I think we are in an island, and we have to figure out how to get a bridge back to the population we care for.
Well, it sounds like you've started to do that by training folks other than physicians, frontline clinicians, by training a broader range of clinicians and other folks who work in the health centers. And I'm wondering whether you see that process already happening or is this all very much in the future?
No, I think that's happening. You know, uniquely to us, outside of being a federally qualified health center, but when we started in the 20 years before we became one, our board was a consumer-dominated board of patients. People who come to us from all over the globe say we're a very sophisticated organization. The one thing that shocks them, which tells me about the disconnect that we have from the population that we serve and care for, is that our board, which is a small board, the majority of our board are people who use us. These are the people who, as Buckminster Fuller said, are Dymaxian. With the smallest amount, they do the most. And we can learn an enormous amount of lessons from our consumers, and we should not be afraid to embrace them as we move forward and try to reimagine and redefine primary care.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
And as well with you, David. Thanks for the great work that you do, and look forward to continuing the conversation.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com, and let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.